I'm not going to sing Billy Madison Back to School again, because people tease me about it here in the studio. But you can listen to an old podcast to hear that, because maybe you all are going to go back to school. The School of Apologetics. Let's take a closer look.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Wednesday here during our week at the Catholic Answers office, and you know what that means. It's Workshop Wednesday. We're halfway through the week, and so I always think it's nice during this time to come into my workshop, my little studio here. Well, it's not my studio. It's officially the G.K. Chesterton studio from which we broadcast Catholic Answers Live and record many of the episodes of the Council of Trent podcast, but also figuratively speaking, here in my office at Catholic Answers to see what am I doing on Workshop Wednesday. What do I do? What do we do here at Catholic Answers? Well, this week, busy as can be, we're coming off our annual conference. I've got a lot of speaking events here. I'm going to be going at the end of the week. I'm going to be traveling to Exeter, New Hampshire, to be giving three talks, one on relativism, another on the hard sayings of the Bible, and finally one on how to talk about tough moral issues. Excited about the trip. It is a amazing there and back. I think this trip will actually be the longest domestic flight I have ever taken, because I was able to get a nonstop from San Diego to Boston. So I'll be going there. And I think on the way back, it's something like 6 hours and 20 minutes to go across the entire country. And so I think that'll be a record domestic flight for me. The longest international flight I've ever been on, I think it was probably 16 hours going from Los Angeles to Sydney, you know, the good old Sydney hop. So I'll be doing that this week and involved in a lot of things here. One thing I just got finished working on here in my office, sending off to our president, El Presidente, El Jefe, Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers, is a curriculum, a sample curriculum for a school of apologetics. And so this is something we've been talking about at Catholic Answers for the longest time. I remember back in the Carl Keating days, when I first got here in 2012, we had these little sit-down meetings. The executive committee and other people would be invited in, like myself, and topics would be raised. And this was one of them, the idea of starting an entire school of apologetics. But it seemed like such a daunting task. We're thinking, well, how are we going to get a whole school going? What will it look like? And finally, through the leadership of one Mr. Christopher Check, it's becoming a reality now. We've already filmed an episode with Jimmy Akin, a mini course on an introduction to apologetics. You can imagine that Jimmy's class is sort of like the appetizer sampler of apologetics. You get little tidbits in all the different areas: atheism, reliability of scripture, Catholic apologetics, all put through there for you to just wet your whistle, your appetite in learning apologetics, just to get started with some of the basics. But I've submitted, working with my colleague, the Ragin' Cajun, Carlo Broussard, we are taking things up a level, up a notch. So we submitted to Chris a sample core curriculum. And so this core curriculum has four concentrations that ideally these would be full-length classes you could take that would be taught by myself or Jimmy or Tim or Carlo. And you would learn, you know, be 20 or 25 hours long in length. Now, some classes will do shorter elective classes, maybe only 6 or 8 hours. But I want these longer classes to be substantive so that they could be transferred for university credit to a Catholic university, one or several that we may partner with in the future. And so that's very exciting for me. So the four concentrations, the four core classes we have proposed, these would be the basics everybody would take. And then you could just do electives on who knows what. They would be philosophical apologetics. So, you know, basic philosophy. They would focus on Christian apologetics. So related to the divinity of Christ, the resurrection of Jesus. I am so sorry. Did you hear the ping? I'm going to be honest with you because you're my friends. And I have to tell you when I get distracted, and I don't want to stop the podcast to record over. I have this thing on my phone, and I always forget to do this. I will set the phone to airplane mode, but it still broadcasts through the internet when I get text messages. So even if I turn the phone to airplane mode, they either come up on my phone or they pop up on my computer. And I have to go in on my iPhone to messages, and I have to slide a button that goes back to not forward my text messages. Now, sometimes this works out great. For example, when I'm flying on an airplane, airplane, like when I'm going to spend 6 hours going to Boston this weekend. I love it because if I have internet in the flight, I can still text my family while I'm at home, even though I don't have any airplane service. I can use iMessage. But it's hard when I'm doing a podcast or on the radio show. I get a wonderful text from friends or family with something that now occupies my mind. Be gone, distracting thought. We need to talk about the school of apologetics. So philosophical apologetics, basic philosophy, reasoning, Christian apologetics, the divinity of Christ, resurrection of Jesus, the Bible, heaven and hell, Catholic apologetics, those Catholic Protestant distinctives, areas that we disagree about, and finally moral apologetics, which is a class I already teach for students at Holy Apostles College who are seeking a master's degree in theology. As an elective credit, they can go to me to get a course in defending the moral teachings of the church. And so I'm excited by what we have coming up. We've put this together in an outline, and I'm really hoping that we'll start taping these classes so that you can watch them at your own speed at home, and there'll probably be, you know, little quizzes and things like that to go with the lessons. And then along with that, there'll be an opportunity that if you want to go deeper, if you would like to take, ideally, if you want to take the course for credit, we'll open up an option where if you pay extra as, you know, kind of a credit fee, you would be able to have interaction with us as apologists. We grade homework and papers, and then you could take your what you've done with the class and take that as credit if you were to go on to university studies, whether you're a young person seeking their first academic credentials or someone who's been established in their career or their life in their parish, and you want to grow your educational knowledge or educational credentials with additional certificates or graduate degrees, things like that. So what I want to talk about on the workshop today is the idea that our school of apologetics, it's not just going to teach people, here's what we believe, why we believe it, here's the Bible, here's church history. I'm excited, and I owe this to my colleague Carla Broussard, who pointed it out. We need to have an entire focus on philosophy. Because in order, I find the best theologians, the best apologists, people who defend the faith well, who are able to explain it well, they are well-skilled and well-versed in philosophy. And that's just such a lost art nowadays. I am amazed that we do not teach high school students. Every high school student should take an introductory, we should offer them introductory philosophy and introduction to critical thinking or logic and teach them that. Because most young people, most people in general, education is put forward this way. I tell you what to know about subject X, and then you regurgitate it back to me onto this test to prove that you know it. And that's all it is. We don't ask people to engage with ideas. We teach them things they should know, not teaching them how they should know or what they should think. And so you have a lot of people. Let's say you have someone, and I hear this trope all the time. I'll talk to people who are not Catholic anymore, and I'll say, well, what's your objection to the Catholic faith? Maybe you have a misunderstanding about something. I don't have a misunderstanding. I completely know the Catholic faith. Really? You do? Oh, yeah. I went to 12 years of Catholic school. You're perched up on their shoulder like this. Like, I know the Catholic faith probably better than you do. I spent 12 years going to Catholic school. To me, that is a sign that you are probably actually misinformed about your faith. This is something I've always thought about writing a book on this. The title would be The Rise, Fall, and Restoration of Catholic Secondary Education in America. I know, real jolting title, but I see it more as a kind of an academic work, wondering what happened with Catholic education. I mean, there was a time when Catholic education was at its peak. It was faithful, orthodox, and these were the brightest kids went to these schools to be prepared to go to college. And I think what happened with a lot of Catholic education in the past 50 years is people looked at the Catholic education model and thought, you know what we need to do? We need to make this just like public schools, but put a crucifix on the wall. That is not how you do this. That is not how you teach students. The other problem is with tuition increasing and making things difficult at the Catholic school, you had a departure, you know, after the Second Vatican Council, when you had a departure, you know, fewer and fewer women embracing religious life to be nuns, fewer and fewer priests who are available to teach. In many of these Catholic schools, a lot of the teaching is done by priests and nuns, and they don't have to be paid very much. They can be paid small stipends. But then when you lose these people, you have to hire qualified lay people. And the qualified lay people who will teach in a Catholic school want to be paid and compensated, and rightly so, the same amount they would receive at a public school or at another private school. And so that drives the costs up. In order to maintain the costs, you have to bring more and more students in, including students who are not really students and families who are not committed to the mission of the Catholic school. And so the advertisement is not, we're a faithful Catholic school. It's, hey, we're a prep school. We're going to get your kid into college. And if that's the number one mission, everything else kind of falls by the wayside. So they get there and they're taught, basically John Dewey's philosophy of education. They're taught something that mirrors public schools. They get theology teaching, but they may have people who, I have heard Catholic high school theology teachers say whoppers to students, things they can't believe. I went to a Catholic high school once. I was invited. I was glad that I was invited. Thankfully, there was someone who believed in my mission to come give a talk on pro-life at a big symposium at the Catholic high school. So I go, and I'm excited to at least get a chance to share the pro-life view because a lot of teachers there were actually secretly opposed. I went to one Catholic high school and I gave a pro-life talk to the faculty. They were laughing and snickering during it. And I asked them at the end of it, I was angry, how many of you want your students to hear this pro-life talk? And out of 30 of them, maybe 5 raised their hands. So if you're going to send your kid to a Catholic school, do the research. Just because there's a crucifix on the wall don't mean nothing. Do the research and make sure that it's Catholic with a capital C, that it really is faithful to what the church teaches. So this other school I went to, I gave a pro-life talk, but at the larger keynote symposium, they brought in a speaker with a degree in women and gender studies. I call that nonsense on stilts, a degree in anti-patriarchal nonsense. And I remember one line he said, he made a joke about his necktie and saying about, patriarchy exists to conform you all, you young men, this is at a Catholic boys' school, to instill these toxic masculine values. I mean, why do we wear neckties, guys? I'll tell you why. It's because there's a noose around our necks that choke away our true masculinity that should be subordinate to femininity. And the necktie has the noose around the neck to kill you, and an arrow at the bottom to point towards your phallus. And all the boys are cheering, and I'm just sitting there, this is absurdity to new levels. And this is someone who was invited by this Catholic school to teach here. So that's the problem. And then when you get in these schools, but not just Catholic schools, it's public schools everywhere else, you're not taught how to think. And if you're not taught how to think, when someone throws an argument at you, when they throw something out at you that's hard to get through, that an argument to refute, instead of just, hey, prove you know this, give me a fact, tell me when the Declaration of Independence was signed, people will instead make arguments against the faith. And no one is trained nowadays to take apart arguments, to say, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. That does not follow. They can't spot fallacies. What's a fallacy? Well, it's an error in reasoning. Here's an example of one. Non sequitur. It does not follow is literally what it means. Non sequitur, I remember reading a logic textbook once. It said, now, non sequiturs aren't all bad. They are an important element in humor, after all. For example, at our Catholic Answers conference a few weeks ago, my colleague Carla Broussard opened talking about Boudreaux and Thibodeau. They're a Cajun duo. They pop up in a lot of Cajun jokes. And I think one of them, Boudreaux is out in his cornfield or whatever, and Thibodeau walks out. He says, what are you doing? And Boudreaux says, I'm getting my PhD. And Thibodeau says, what do you mean? How are you getting a PhD? You're just here in the cornfield. And Boudreaux says, well, yeah, they say to get a PhD, you have to be outstanding in your field. Get it? Outstanding in your field. So obviously it doesn't follow to be outstanding in your field that you should literally go and be outstanding in a cornfield. Non sequitur, it doesn't follow. That one actually is also a fallacy of equivocation. That is when you make an argument and you take terms that may be spelled the same but actually have two different meanings. Let me give you an example. Someone sent me an email recently. They were very distressed. They were reading... is a young man, actually. I think he's about 13 years old, and he emails me from time to time with questions about the faith. And I'm happy to oblige him, because when I was 13 years old, I was a wreck. I wish I was as far along as this kid. So if I can point a young person in the right direction and I have the time to do so, I will gladly do it, because I wish I had had somebody like that at my age. And when I was 16, 17, I had people like that at my parish that I started going to. I had young adults and people in college who could do that for me. And he said he was looking at a survey that showed that intelligent people are more likely to be atheists. Atheists tend to be more intelligent than the rest of the population. He said that makes them nervous. Should I be Catholic? I mean, smart people are usually atheists. But here I reassured him and said, well, wait, just because intelligence and atheism are correlated, they go hand in hand, that doesn't prove that atheism is a good thing. It doesn't prove that at all. Because there's an underlying assumption here. Like when you learn philosophy, when you learn how to think, you're able to find hidden assumptions and arguments and exploit them. So when someone says intelligent people are more likely to be atheists, they're making this implicit argument. And this is what you do when you learn philosophy. You hear an argument is usually presented as like one or two sentences with a lot of assumptions built in. So here is the argument that's implicitly being made. Intelligent people are, you know, usually right about things. And intelligent people are usually atheists. They usually lack a belief in God. Therefore, we should imitate intelligent people and also lack a belief in God. But that doesn't follow at all. First, just because someone is intelligent doesn't mean, one, of course, it doesn't mean they're right about everything, doesn't mean that they're omniscient. And second, if atheism comes from high intelligence, that could be a defect of intelligence. That sometimes people with high intelligence, they end up having personality defects that are a hindrance to them. This is an excerpt from an article in Scientific American. It says, in a study just published in the journal Intelligence, Pitzer College researcher Ruth Karpinski and her colleagues emailed a survey with questions about psychological and physiological disorders to members of Mensa. So Mensa is the high IQ society. I never really understood why people join Mensa, because if you truly are smart enough to be a genius, you probably wouldn't have a desire to be part of a genius club. Why would you bother to want to do that? The people who want to join Mensa usually aren't smart enough to. The people who are smart enough, I don't think they usually do. But Mensa seems to have a lot of members. So these people can pass these intelligence tests. They have an IQ of 132. And so they did these surveys, and it turns out many of Mensa's highly intelligent members are more likely to suffer a range of serious disorders. The biggest differences between the Mensa group and the general population are seen in mood disorders and anxiety disorders. More than a quarter of the sample reported they had been formally diagnosed with a mood disorder, while 20% reported an anxiety disorder. The differences were smaller, but still statistically significant and practically meaningful for most of the other disorders. So it goes on talking about, you know, these anomalies that people have. So sometimes having a high intelligence can be a curse as much as it is a blessing. That there are people I know who are incredibly smart, leaps and bounds above other people, yet they don't seem to grasp basic social truths about interacting with other people. They can be cold and distant and have a hard time relating to other people. So what's funny there is sometimes people who are the most intelligent, they miss these basic truths about humanity and about human beings. And so if these basic relational truths escape them, it's no wonder that they end up, missing out on the most important relational truth of all, which is their relationship with God. Also, what's funny is people deep down, it's kind of funny. There are people who will say, I'm not a religious person. I'm not one of those gullible religious people. I'm a skeptic. I'm not into that religion thing. Ironically, many people who are not religious still have religious thinking. They just end up believing in the paranormal rather than the religious. This is an article from the New York Times written by Clay Rutledge back in July of 2017. I think it said, don't believe in God. Maybe you'll try UFOs. It says that roughly 30% of Americans report they have felt in contact with someone who has died. Nearly 20% believe they have been in the presence of a ghost. About one third of Americans believe ghosts exist and can harm humans. Two thirds hold supernatural or paranormal beliefs of some kind. Now, here's the kicker. The Rutledge goes on to say, these numbers are much higher than they were in previous decades, when more people reported being highly religious. People who do not frequently attend church are twice as likely to believe in ghosts as those who are regular churchgoers. The less religious people are, the more likely they are to endorse empirically unsupported ideas about UFOs, like they're aliens that the government is covering up. So I think that's important to point out. And if you see people who have, they are dismissive towards, now some atheists I know are across the board. They'll say they don't believe in ghosts, UFOs. The atheists that I interact with online sometimes, they're going to be naturalists across the board. But even they will believe in unobservable entities, like they believe in quarks and strings or a multiverse as the fundamental element of reality. So at the end of the day, I think we all believe in invisible things that make life possible. But many people who you meet who just say, well, I'm just not very religious, you should point out if they believe in things that point to a transcendental realm, if they really believe in horoscopes, if they believe in ghosts or the paranormal or fate or other things like this, you can say, well, look, you believe in this, but wouldn't you like to see where does the evidence point when it comes to all this? If someone believes in ghosts, by the way, I would definitely recommend, whether they're religious or not, sharing with them the podcast I recently did with Jimmy Akin on the paranormal and specifically on the existence of ghosts. I think you might find that to be incredibly helpful. Finally, here's another argument that will come up to show why philosophy is so important, why you need that to address claims that are made. So when it comes to intelligent people being atheists, and so I sent that response to that 13-year-old kid, and he was very, very grateful to receive it. Another person also asked me about scientists. He said, hey, I heard that like 93% of scientists are atheists, like nearly all scientists are atheists. Doesn't that mean that we should be atheists? No, that doesn't follow at all because, once again, put our philosophy hats on, science is not, God, the question whether God exists is not a scientific question. It's not. It belongs in the realm of philosophy. Scientists are no more equipped to answer, hard scientists like biologists, chemists, physicists, they are no more equipped to answer questions about God than they are equipped to answer questions about Shakespeare or democracy or ancient Rome. It's beyond their level of expertise, or philosophical questions like ethics, which moral system is true, philosophical questions about time and space and identity, about free will, aesthetics. It's just outside of that realm. And also this, you know, when people say this, when they say, oh, well scientists generally believe in, they're 93% atheists, that's a poll from the National Academy of Scientists, which only has about 2,000 members. There are about 2 million scientists in the United States, and over half of them believe in God or a higher power. So there are more atheists among scientists. But as Elaine Eklund has shown in her book on science and religion, where the real conflict lies, she says that actually in many cases, atheism is prevalent among older scientists, and that it's the case that many people are, it's not the case that science turned them into atheists, but that atheism is something they previously held, and that motivated them to enter into the hard sciences as a field of study. So just to keep that in mind that, yeah, maybe this small group of scientists, the National Academy of Scientists, they don't believe in God, but it's a self-selected group. It's not representative of a whole sample. And it, once again, science is not a way of figuring out if God exists. Like saying, well, science hasn't found God, so he doesn't exist, is like saying this metal detector hasn't found any diamond gems here on the beach, therefore there are no diamond gems. Now, I'm sure a diamond could have fallen out of someone's engagement ring, but a metal detector can't find a precious gem. It's the wrong tool for the job. Or it's just the same way. Science is the wrong tool for finding God because God is not a material object within the space-time universe. God exists beyond the universe. He created it. He transcends it. He's the ultimate basic foundation for the universe and reality itself. And if you would like, if you want more on science, religion, and where the divide is, or is the divide kind of a myth people have come up with, I hope you will tune in tomorrow because I'm going to be doing a interview with Dr. Stacey Trusenkos, author of Particles of Faith. She is a PhD chemist who worked for DuPont, has a master's degree in theology, and we had a wonderful conversation about God and the atom, chemistry, quantum physics, and how it all points back to our Catholic faith. I hope you will tune in tomorrow for that. that you will recommend the podcast to others and become a premium subscriber at trenthornpodcast.com. If you do that, you get access to bonus content. I think this week I uploaded my thoughts on the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation for premium members. If you want to hear my thoughts on politics, you can get that if you're a subscriber at trenthornpodcast.com for as little as $5 a month. And then hopefully in the next few weeks, I'll be sharing to my premium members a sneak peek of the audio version of my book, Why We're Catholic, that we're currently recording here at Catholic Answers to be our first audiobook product. So thank you guys for listening. I hope you really enjoyed sitting in on the workshop here with me on Workshop Wednesday. And I hope that you all have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.